Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, "He Just Can't Wait to Be King of Solar." Strata Solar founder and CEO Marcus Wilhelm is building a solar empire from his Chapel Hill headquarters. And that's the headline on the front of the Triangle Business Journal. The actual article begins inside with a second headline. When it comes to solar, Marcus Wilhelm says he'll go big or go home. CEO of Strata Solar is pushing for more aggressive solar policy in North Carolina. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Marcus Wilhelm thought it would be a routine town council hearing for his Chapel Hill-based solar farm development firm, Strata Solar. With 119 solar farms under its belt and about 50 more in development in 2016, Strata Solar is no stranger to local government bureaucracy. A project under discussion last December in the small eastern North Carolina community of Woodland should have been no different. But after about $300,000 of infrastructure investments by Strata, council members rejected his site proposal, citing a slew of resident concerns, from solar panels' alleged cancer-causing potential to worries that panels would block photosynthesis and prevent area plants from growing. "It happens," Wilhelm says, gritting his teeth and moving on with the conversation. But it doesn't happen a lot, not to Wilhelm, who in a short time has become one of the giants in the industry. Since launching Strata Solar in 2011, his teams have installed more than 700 megawatts of solar power. In 2014, the company celebrated reaching the $1 billion mark in project investments in North Carolina alone. Last year's announced projects included a 450-acre, 50-megawatt solar project in Mississippi and a 10.6-megawatt AC solar facility in Alabama. Still, in a world where low oil prices actually slow adoption, it's a constant fight, and not just against traditional energy players. The elusive CEO fights misinformation. He fights margins, and perhaps the most intense of all his battles, he fights politics. North Carolina, with an estimated 5,950 solar jobs, is the number 9 state for solar careers, according to the Solar Foundation, and number 2 in the nation for solar capacity. But Wilhelm fears changes in state incentives may negatively impact those rankings. If North Carolina politics don't align with the solar empire he's building, he says he can take his 300-person company, 1,700 in the field, someplace that will. "We'll see," says Donald Vandervaart, who heads the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, and among those Wilhelm calls out as having a lack of perspective when it comes to solar. "They haven't moved yet." Green beginnings. The bulk of Wilhelm's pre-solar career was in publishing, an industry where he and his fellow executives desperately tried to shake a digital tide. Born in Germany, Wilhelm, now 57, came to the United States in 1986. His career has included leadership roles at Bertelsmann AG and Time Warner. He served as CEO of Doubleday Direct and Bookspan before doing what he says he'll never do again. He retired. He and his wife Kathy settled in Chapel Hill for what he thought was retirement and a few golf games. But he couldn't stay away from the business world for long. He started by financing a builder in Chapel Hill. Then in 2008, the market crashed. "I said, let's make these houses green and put solar panels on top," he recalls. Seemingly more as a point of interest than a full entrepreneurship play, he went to a solar convention for more insight. He got hooked on the idea that the energy tide was changing and Strata Solar was born. The hook was the tide itself, not just the technology. Another traditional industry, this time energy, not publishing, was about to turn upside down. "It reminds me so much of the early internet days when book selling moved to the internet and Jeff Bezos and these guys were out there revolutionizing the industry," he says, calling Bezos an acquaintance. "That disruptive technology and the impact it had on a business paradigm is something that I was really familiar with." So, in 2011, the betting began. Are we crazy? That first farm was 5 megawatts in Shelby in 2011. At the time, A 1-megawatt farm was perceived as a monster of a project, Wilhelm says. If we would have tanked, the whole company, Strata, would have been done, he recalls. That first farm took 6 months to build. Today, the same farm would take 6 weeks. We all looked at each other, he says. Are we crazy? The perception in 2011 was that the math wouldn't work. But the next year, his company built 11 farms and 29 the year after. He credits his business insight, not his technical know-how or environmental altruism, with Strata's trajectory. You cannot build a business that stands out if you do what everybody else does, right? Wilhelm says. You have to find your own way. When books had different sizes and formats, he looked at standardizing book production. Similarly, standardizing solar farm development and decreasing margins through efficient operations was how he would make the math work. There is a perception out there that renewable energy is too expensive, he says. The perception exists for a reason. Residential customers with solar panels on their roofs see the meter spin backwards as they get credited for the power they're producing. They're refunded at a retail rate, say 11 cents per kilowatt hour. When Wilhelm sells power back to Duke Energy, it's at wholesale prices, meaning that 11 cents becomes about 6 cents. The only way to make money with that kind of math was to use multiplication to create volume. You don't build a car on a one-by-one basis, he says. The business model. Installing solar panels in bulk for a utility-scale project requires a lot of capital, typically about $10 million for each project, approximately $1.50 per watt, although prices vary, acquired from a mix of sources, from investment bankers to tax investors. The return on their investment can come anywhere between 4 and 14 years, depending on the type of investment. And many of the wealthy have taken the bait. Industry experts peg global solar industry revenue at about $60 billion as of 2013 and project more than double that, about $137 billion, by 2020. While the numbers reflect an opportunity, the ROI, return on investment, hurdles are evident too. In the end, the model largely is based on scale. The energy price Strata and other solar companies get from utilities, such as Duke Energy, is fixed by the North Carolina Utilities Commission, explains Brian O'Hara, Strata's Senior Vice President of Strategy and Government Affairs. Over the years, the commission has lowered that price, making solar more competitive with other energy sources such as natural gas. Andrea Luck, Executive Director for the Solar Foundation, says the utility-scale solar projects Wilhelm and others are creating are more labor-efficient than small-scale residential or commercial projects. You have fewer people working on projects to install the same amount of megawatts of solar, she says. It's a lot more labor-efficient to install. Typically, she says, these types of projects don't mean a lot of local jobs, as the companies developing them are headquartered elsewhere. When the project is done, sometimes those folks will leave, she says. Not so with Strata, says O'Hara, which has implemented more than 100 solar farms in North Carolina alone and has held job fairs in eastern North Carolina to fill labor roles. But no one gets rich off of a single solar farm. While Strata retains ownership in some of its farms, others are sold by the bundle to improve the acquisition economics. Today, Strata has grown from that first farm in Shelby to own 50% of the market in North Carolina, and recent investments show the company is expanding across the country. Defining clean energy. While his goal is to keep the headquarters in Chapel Hill, state politics have Wilhelm thinking about contingency plans, which could include relocating. We can deal with good and bad news, but we cannot deal with constant surprises and somewhat irrational interpretations of what renewables are all about, he says. He's referring to efforts made by leaders such as Vandervaart to reclassify natural gas and nuclear into a category that would include solar. However, Vandervaart clarified in an interview that he never sought to redefine the sectors, just to broaden the definition of clean energy. He says he's not attacking solar, just trying to get nuclear, the segment he calls the only true clean energy, into the incentives conversation. Even solar and wind necessitate some backup power source that's fossil fuel generated, he says. Nuclear doesn't need that. He says he believes the solar industry will continue to grow in the state, tax incentives or no tax incentives. It's natural for them to want incentives, he says, of industry execs such as Wilhelm, but we believe, and they believe, they can still make their business model work very well. While incentives may have brought the solar industry here, Vandervaart says the hope is that the solar industry soon won't need any incentives, pointing to what he calls a dramatic reduction in the cost of the technology since 2008. Duke Energy CEO Lynn Good, whose company is among North Carolina's largest solar investors, says there's a huge tailwind when it comes to solar energy in the state, but solar can only go so far. We can build lots of solar, but it's only going to be available when the sun is shining, she says. The role of politics. Wilhelm says it's not just about the tax credits. He sees a conspiracy wider than the state, one marked by lobbying investments from the oil and gas industry and powerful financiers like the Koch brothers. I was on their side when we printed books, he says. I get it. I understand they have an interest. They need to do what they need to do, and we need to make our case. He believes there are legislators whose sole goal is to put Strata and businesses like it out of business. Ivan Erlob, executive director of the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association, says North Carolina's policies and regulatory rules enacted in the mid-2000s specifically to entice entrepreneurs like Wilhelm helped lessen the gamble. Since then, we have made it possible to achieve economies of scale. It's enabled all of us to learn how to reduce the cost of implementing clean energy like solar, he says, adding that utility-scale solar companies are no longer dependent on the credits. In the past two decades, the cost of doing business has come down more than 80%. Erlob says nuclear is an expensive endeavor, with regulatory challenges that don't exist with solar. And natural gas price fluctuations are felt more intensely than ever before, he says. It's important to diversify and not put all our eggs in one basket, he says. Not ready for a sunset. Wilhelm won't say where he'd go. He does mention that he's had recent meetings in Arizona, but his comments aren't isolated, Erlob says. He's heard others express frustration at North Carolina politics. Strata is an example of a leading downstream firm, Erlob says. It's putting North Carolina on the map for industry leadership. We have the potential to easily, within 10 years, be a $30 billion industry, if not far larger than that, and it's extremely important that we stay on that course. As for Wilhelm, he's convinced his business model will continue to work. I could have retired and just lived comfortably, a regular life, but it's not me, he says. This is me. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. The main headline, some elbow room with Chip Wade. And this is a Q&A. Popular HGTV network star Chip Wade is coming to the Southern Ideal Home Show in Raleigh in April. Wade is host of renovation show Elbow Room, co-host of Wise Buys with his realtor wife Polly, and member of the remodeling team for Curb Appeal, The Block, and Design to Sell. What are some of the biggest challenges in making a too-tight space work for growing families? One, having too much furniture that doesn't fit the way you actually live, and two, misappropriated storage solutions. Consider consolidating furnishings and replacing with a more multinational unit, like a table that doubles as a desk or a work surface, or seating that works for two different spaces. When it comes to storage, it helps to pull everything out and really see what you want to store. I recommend building your storage to fit perfectly what you want to store, rather than building generic storage like open shelves that tend to get overpacked. What are some of the most common features requested by homeowners who say, there's not enough room? Typically, this request ends up with a remodel that joins the kitchen and living room. Oftentimes, it is about finding one space where you can pull square footage together and removing items in that space and creating other storage solutions. Do you have any plans to film any HGTV shows in the Raleigh-Durham area in the near future? Right now, we are looking at potential new episodes of our newest series, Deal Estate, on HGTV, which is a new one-hour series hosted by my wife and me. We are filming in Atlanta right now, but Raleigh is just a stone's throw away. From Curb Appeal, what would you say are the most important features and best investments to create an aesthetically pleasing street view? 1. A clearly defined path to the front door with adequate lighting and address signage. 2. Making sure if you have a front-facing garage door that you address the styling and quality in a way that accentuates your architecture. 3. A classic landscape design that incorporates year-round aesthetic and intrigue, leaving your front approach looking maintained year-round. What are you most looking forward to about your visit to Raleigh? I love the people of North Carolina. Everyone is so friendly, it makes it feel like home. And in a section called Around Town, stories you might not hear at Toastmasters. At the recent Shop Local Raleigh annual event at the Glenwood Club, Raleigh small business leaders Gaurav G. Patel of Echelon Experiences, George York of York Properties, and J.P. Finney of the Unleashed Pet Store chain were asked to tell a story that they wouldn't normally tell in front of a crowd. Here are their stories. Gaurav G. Patel. When he and Mitel Patel, a Raleigh lawyer and board president at Shop Local Raleigh, were growing up, their first cousins, their family owned a small hotel, and the boys' job on the weekends was to help clean rooms. So, when there were two beds, we'd chase around and see who could make a bed the fastest. I kicked his beep every time. Mattel, in the crowd, disputed that assertion, screaming out, "Under a minute." George York. York grew up in Raleigh, but one summer he had a job working at a Little Caesars pizza shop in Wilmington. Not challenged enough by that job, he put in an application to be an actor for movie and TV production companies in town. I was actually selected, though no speaking parts, in a movie called Amos and Andy. I was in the Matlock season opener, 2-hour special. I was a lawyer in the background. For another movie, I had to learn how to dance the 1920s and 30s dance style for young Indiana Jones. So if anyone wants to learn the foxtrot, I think I can still remember that. J.P. Finney. I dropped out of high school and am now in charge of all of the accounting for Unleashed. The company now has 7 pet store locations in Raleigh, Cary, and Wilmington, and employs 35 people. And in the fashion section, Russell Wilson launches clothing line at Nordstrom. Seattle Seahawks quarterback and former NC State University player Russell Wilson has 3 loves in life: faith, his family, and football. Now he can add another F word, fashion. On February 29, Wilson launched his new clothing line, Good Man Brand, at Nordstrom's flagship store in Seattle. "I'm going to be the guy who is going to be all over the pictures," he said during a public question and answer session with Nordstrom co-president Pete Nordstrom. Wilson describes the clothing as ideal for the 24-year-old who is trying to land his first good job out of college, or, as he said, the 27-year-old like him who is dating a woman way out of his league. Wilson is currently dating singer Ciara. The brand will be available in 15 Nordstrom locations and 65 specialty men's stores across the country. The company donates $3 from every Good Man Brand item purchased to Wilson's Why Not You Foundation. And finally, in a section called 15 Minutes of Fame, no, Forrest Gump didn't come up with this phrase. According to Wikipedia, the iconic popular phrase, "beep happens," first appeared not during movie character Forrest Gump's run, but in print in 1983 in the classroom of UNC Chapel Hill professor Connie Ebel, who collected new slang words and phrases from her students. Ebel and the anonymous student who wrote down the phrase regained some notoriety recently when the Daily Tar Heel profiled the professor and the phrase. From a business perspective, neither Ebel nor UNC saw a dime from the phrase, even if they did likely coin it. That's partly because it's all but impossible to place a copyright on something so short. I think they would have gotten nowhere if they would have tried, says Deborah Gearhart, associate professor at the UNC School of Law. It's just not sufficiently original. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The main headline, Here Comes More Crabtree. Developers kick off first phase of Crabtree North apartments at Overture. The owners of the proposed 20-acre Crabtree North development project on the north side of Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh have sold off a key piece of land for Phase 1 construction, a 203-unit senior housing apartment community called Overture Crabtree North. At the same time, the retail leasing leader at Lennar Commercial says they are also ramping up efforts to get the ball rolling on Carolina Row, the 125,000-square-foot retail and residential project at Crabtree North that will prominently front Glenwood Avenue. We are actively in leasing mode, says Kelly Wilson, the new senior leasing manager assigned to the Carolina Row project for Lennar Commercial. Wilson says she will be pitching the project to various retail groups at the ICSC Carolinas Conference in March, but she could give no firm details yet when the project might break ground. The company's website states that the grand opening is projected in late fall 2017. Rezoning for the entire Crabtree North site was approved in 2013 and allows for up to 708 new apartment units, plus 125,000 square feet of new retail, restaurant, and commercial spaces. EYC Companies of South Carolina is the owner and master developer. But so far, the only piece to move forward with concrete construction plans is the Overture Crabtree North project. An affiliate of Graystar, a Charleston-based apartment development and management firm, has paid $3.85 million for the 8 parcels inside the Charles Drive loop that connects into Lead Mine Road just north of its intersection with Glenwood Avenue, according to county records. Ben Liebetraw, a senior director of development at Graystar, says construction crews are starting site work in early March, and the company expects to open its clubhouse and first apartments by late summer 2017, with the rest of the apartment project completed by early fall that year. Perimeter Park owners announce new leases, amenities, and expansions. It's been nearly a year since a new joint venture group took over the ownership of Perimeter Park in Morrisville, one of the largest and busiest business parks in the Triangle. In that time, the group is reporting they've signed 441,736 square feet in new leases, renewals, and expansions at the 21 office and flex buildings they control at Perimeter Park. Trial Card, Simplivity Corporation, UNC Physicians, Landis and GYR, LMHT Associates, and NC Dental have all signed new office leases at Perimeter Park, while Progress Software, KBR Engineering, and MCI Metro Access Transmission Services have renewed and expanded their lease contracts. The Perimeter Park owners have also committed to adding a fitness and amenity center, one that Perimeter Park developers have been promising for years. Plans are underway to equip a newly dedicated 7,207-square-foot space in the Perimeter 4 building with boxing machines, a CrossFit multi-station, locker rooms, and showers. A new cafe will be operated by Southern Foods and will offer the full Starbucks drink menu, as well as breakfast, lunch, and snack specials. Plans are also underway to enhance signage, expand the park's food truck program, and add additional gathering spaces. Cary Park condos to be completed. Apex-based Concordia Building Company has stepped in to take over development at the Waterford Lakeside at Cary Park Condominium Community in Cary, where two building slabs were started but never finished after financing dried up shortly after the first building was built in 2007. Concordia, led by company president and Quebec native Steve Boucher, has taken over the last two building lots next to the condo building at 1200 Waterford Lake Drive, with plans to break ground in May. The new buildings are expected to have 18 condo units each that will range in price from $200,000 to $350,000. New lab office at NC State's Centennial Biomedical Campus slated for 2017 opening. Raleigh real estate development firm Capital Associates has announced plans to open in 2017 what will be the first private-owned office and laboratory building on NC State University's Centennial Biomedical Campus. The 44,500-square-foot building project has been in the works since 2007, when Capital Associates was picked over three other bidders for the project to partner with the university. The project was put on hold when the economic recession in 2008 made it difficult to find financing or tenants. NC State's College of Veterinary Medicine will be leasing the bulk of the second floor of the new building, says Brett Muller, a partner in the project with Tom Huff at Capital Associates. The remainder of the building, which will be about 75% lab space to 25% office space, will be available for lease. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline: internal records document Raleigh's GE loss to Boston. Project Moonshot started in November 2014 when economic development officials in North Carolina filed a project briefing memo that Connecticut industrial giant General Electric was interested in moving its headquarters to Raleigh. Fast forward to January 13, 2016, and GE made the rejection official, saying it would be moving its 600-job headquarters to Boston. While executives deemed North Carolina's proposal competitive, there were too many obstacles. GE visits North Carolina. In June 2015, Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, said in a memo that the state was almost certainly on GE's shortlist. GE, he wrote, was 95% certain they'll move out of Connecticut. In late July, economic officials were invited to meet in person with GE at its Fairfield offices. GE said it was looking for at least 200,000 square feet of space. It was open to both downtown and downtown outskirt locations, not a traditional corporate campus, much more urban feel, said Chung in a September 21 email. On October 7, the group gathered in the Triangle to tour Research Triangle Park's new Park Center campus. American Underground, Downtown Durham, Citrix, and NC State University Centennial Campus, according to a schedule memo. They'd meet with Governor Pat McCrory and talk tech talent pool and check out the urban views of Raleigh and Durham, and they'd check Charlotte as well. Throughout, North Carolina Economic Development Team's biggest challenge appeared to be one of perception. According to notes emailed by Chung on October 16, there are some folks who think Raleigh's too small of a town. To combat that frame of thinking, Chung's team sent more lists of Triangle accolades as well as a play-by-play for how both Citrix and Red Hat developed their Raleigh campuses. Officials even created an iPad app to introduce GE to the Triangle. The Big Rally. At a second October visit, the state gathered even more area executives, as well as university and school officials. According to a Chung memo dated October 27, the meeting was also for the GE execs to meet with the chairman and CEO to talk next steps. Obviously, we're aware that some of the C-suite folks may still have reservations about the size of this market, but hopefully the visit helped to change some of their preconceptions about this area, Chung said in an email in October. Interest declines. As time went on, however, GE's interest appeared to wane, and in January the news was delivered. GE Vice President of Environment, Health, and Safety, Ann Klee, wrote North Carolina Commerce Secretary John Scavarla to say officially that the search was focusing on the Northeast. I'm really sorry that Raleigh didn't work for us, she read, adding that several of us felt Raleigh would have been a great new alternative. It was very competitive, she said, of North Carolina's proposal, but just couldn't get us past our obstacles. NetApp workers get pink slips at RTP campus. Layoff notifications officially hit the NetApp campus in Research Triangle Park. Company spokeswoman Megan Fintland says via email that most of the employees impacted by a recently announced company-wide restructuring plan were notified by close of business March 1. The company disclosed in February a plan to cut up to 12% of its workforce, about 1,500 employees. While it has not outlined the specifics of how the cuts will impact RTP, it has offered more insight into how the cuts will impact expansion plans. In 2012, the firm pledged to create 460 jobs with an average annual salary of about $100,000 over 4 years and to invest more than $75 million into a research and development facility in RTP. The internet storage giant received a $3.61 million reimbursement from the state in 2014 for meeting milestones relating to that planned expansion. It qualified for a total of $11.78 million under JDIG as long as it meets its targets and sustains them for 10 years. Finland says that while the company was able to meet its investment target for 2015, it didn't hit its jobs milestone. NetApp has long been a power player in RTP. According to Triangle Business Journal Research, it's the Triangle's 24th largest employer with about 1,600 local employees. It has not disclosed a 2016 headcount. Janet Cowell joins Channel Advisor Board of Directors. State Treasurer Janet Cowell, the woman at the helm of North Carolina's $87 billion pension fund, looks to be diversifying her own financial portfolio. Channel Advisor, a Mooresville-based commerce software firm, announced that Cowell would be joining its board, an appointment that means she'll receive a $50,000 annual retainer and a stock award currently valued at $150,000. Cree hits major milestone in LED technology. Another year, another milestone for Durham-based LED innovator Cree. Cree says via a prepared statement that it's recorded an industry first, increasing the number of lumens in a single high-power LED to 1,600 lumens at 134 lumens per watt. It's a complicated-sounding milestone, which basically means Cree has developed the technology for even more efficiency. A breakthrough, the company says, will lead to LED systems with increased performance, lower cost, and better light. CEO Chuck Swoboda has said repeatedly that innovation will be Cree's differentiator and that Cree will be willing to pay for it. Over the past several quarters, its investment in R&D has been pretty steady. And now we turn to On Healthcare, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, a competitive shift. Area hospitals are focusing more on collaborations. Triangle hospitals could, and some say should, do more to collaborate with each other instead of competing against one another, something that could ultimately reduce healthcare costs for Triangle residents. Dr. John Piotkowski, WakeMed Health and Hospital's Senior Vice President of Physician Practices, Dr. Ravish Shashkar, UNC Rex Heart and Vascular Physician in Chief, and Dr. David Zoss, President of Duke Raleigh Hospital, discussed competition and collaboration at a healthcare roundtable hosted by the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. Triangle hospitals provide really good care, they agreed, but that good care comes with a price. This is the best place in the world for what I would call Superman care, Piotkowski said, referring to top-level oncology or other specialty care. The reality is that it's also some of the most expensive in the country. That's especially the case as to healthcare that actually keeps people healthy, not treats a high-level disease. The best part about healthcare is not needing it, Piotkowski said. Historically, the three Raleigh hospitals have looked to compete more than collaborate. Consider two recent examples, the WakeMed North Family Health and Women's Hospital that opened in late 2015 and the NC Heart and Vascular Hospital under construction at UNC Rex Healthcare. These two projects cost some $300 million combined and were pursued as a way to gain market share. There is reason to think that the competitive environment is changing, due in no small part to turnover in the corner offices of all three hospitals. Zass became president in mid-2014. Donald Ginzig became president of WakeMed in 2013. And Steve Burris became Rex's president just last year. Donald, Steve, and I actually work very closely together, Zass said. adding with a chuckle that maybe we should do a better job of communicating that sometimes. Sakar, a cardiovascular surgeon, pointed specifically to stroke care, where a collaborative environment could improve patient care and reduce costs. When a stroke occurs, every second is crucial because the longer that blood is cut off from the brain, the more damage is likely to occur. It's impossible for any one hospital to treat all stroke patients in Wake County, and a partnered approach to care to stroke care could benefit all residents, he says. A popular economic theory espouses that all competition is ultimately good for the consumer. All three panelists pointed out that for healthcare, the forces of competition don't function in quite the same way. Right off the top, the government is a major payer of healthcare through Medicare and Medicaid, and negotiated contracts with major health insurers cover nearly all the remaining patients. We are not in a free market economy, Piotrowski said. Of course, that doesn't mean hospitals should give up competing on issues like emergency department wait times or quality metrics. I don't think you want to eliminate the competition, Zha said. UNC Med School to open Wilmington campus. The UNC School of Medicine will open a Wilmington campus at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. In addition to the main campus in Chapel Hill, the School of Medicine already has other campus locations in Asheville and Charlotte. North Carolina has a serious physician maldistribution problem in which physicians are clustered near urban centers, leaving rural areas lacking in needed healthcare services. To its credit, UNC has tried innovative programs to tilt the scales in the other direction, though these efforts can take decades to begin to take serious effect. Good opens up about local jobs, clean energy, Dan River. And actually, before we read that article, let's finish off the On Healthcare page with a section on They Said It. The quote, "At the same time we are being prudent with our available capital and made the difficult decision to undertake a 20% reduction in our workforce in January." That was Dr. Michelle Berry, Chimeric CEO, announcing layoffs at the company. The cuts came shortly after the company disclosed unexpected and disappointing trial results testing brincidofovir, the company's lead compound. The next quote, "What's so great about Boston?" That's from Prabha Fernandez, founder and CEO of Sempra Pharmaceuticals, is the 2016 co-chair of the Council for Entrepreneurial Development Life Science Conference discussing a dearth of venture capital investments in North Carolina. The state took in $676 million of VC money in 2015, compared with $27 billion in Silicon Valley and $6 billion in Boston. And finally, in a section called On the Move, Ingram to remain chairman of Valiant Board. Bob Ingram, a titan in the pharmaceutical industry who makes his home in Durham, will stay on as the Valiant Pharmaceuticals International Chairman of the Board. He has long been a board member and stepped in as chairman when J. Michael Pearson took a leave of absence after being hospitalized with pneumonia. Pearson returned to his role of CEO, but Valiant separated the chairman role and appointed Ingram full-time. And now we'll get to that article in the energy section titled, "Good Opens Up About Local Jobs, Clean Energy, Dan River." Duke Energy President, Chairman, and CEO Lynn Good says Raleigh continues to be an important piece of the power giant's plan. Speaking nearly 4 years after Duke's pledge to maintain 1,000 employees in Raleigh following its merger with Progress Energy, she told a crowd at Triangle Business Journal's Power Breakfast, gathered March 1 at the Umstead Hotel in Cary, that the area continues to play a significant role. "I hope you've seen nothing but great commitment from Duke Energy to this region, and that commitment is not going to change," she says, pointing to Duke's investments in renewables and the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in eastern North Carolina. "The role of this community in Raleigh will always be important to Duke." Good was asked directly if she envisioned a time where the Raleigh headcount would be transferred to Charlotte. She says no. "The last thing I need to do is put 1,000 more people in downtown Charlotte," she says. As for the future of clean energy, nuclear could be key, but it's expensive and regulatory hurdles can be limiting. Good says that if the country is serious about a low-carbon future in 2050, we would be building new nuclear today. Duke continues to keep the option alive, she says, adding that the company continues to work toward a commercial operation license for a new site in South Carolina. I also think it's important to think about nuclear from a global perspective, she says, pointing to the fact that four such stations are under development in the country. In China, there are 25. If we fast forward a decade, we could find ourselves in a situation where we are no longer the leader in nuclear power, she says. On reportedly private meetings between Duke leaders and Governor Pat McCrory and other officials, we are the energy infrastructure of North Carolina. It's important that we have discussions with a broad range of people. On solar, I think there's a huge tailwind. On terrorism, if I were to share with you the number of attacks that come into the Duke network every day, you would be astounded. It's not from people working in their garage, it's from nation states. We spend a lot of resources and time building defense. On diversity, we recruit to find employees with diverse backgrounds. I think diversity is a journey we are always working toward, and it's important at Duke. On her reaction to the Dan River spill, I could have said, let's work on repairing Dan River and then we'll look at repairing the system, she says, adding that it was important to Duke to look ahead and concurrently inspect all the sites. As you think about any difficult issue you're dealing with, always having a guiding principle is important. And that article was written by Lauren Onasorge. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the first column we read is written by Sheila Holman, who is the director of the Air Quality Division in the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. The headline on her Viewpoint article, New Air Quality Regs Designed to Protect Small Businesses. Companies will be encouraged to protect the air quality and state regulators will be able to focus on larger sources of air pollution thanks to a rule recently passed by a state environmental commission. In keeping with Governor Pat McCrory's initiatives to improve government efficiency and protect the environment, the rule will improve air quality while cutting costs and red tape for small businesses. Under the rule developed by the State Environmental Department, about 1,200 very small industrial facilities would remain subject to environmental standards, but would no longer be required to hold an air quality permit. The primary emissions from facilities that would qualify under the rule account for less than 1% of statewide emissions from factories and businesses. The rule does not remove or relax any existing emissions standards. State regulators will continue to issue permits, conduct inspections, and collect data on larger sources that account for more than 99% of air emissions from industrial facilities. The resources that are freed up by reducing paperwork for very small sources of air pollution will be focused on additional inspections and on larger, more environmentally significant sources of emissions. Industrial facilities will have to keep and maintain any air pollution control equipment they already have in place, and they could be inspected at any time, whether they are exempt from permitting requirements or not. Experience has proven that businesses will reduce emissions when they have incentives like those provided in the new rule. North Carolinians are breathing cleaner air than at any time in the past 20 years due to fundamental changes in our energy sector, including converting coal-fired plants to natural gas to create cleaner and cheaper energy. The new air permit rule will continue to protect the air we breathe while relieving some small businesses from the costs and regulatory burdens of having air permits. And the next Viewpoint column is written by Joe Branticelli, who writes about business travel for Upstart Business Journal, a sister publication to Triangle Business Journal. The headline on his Viewpoint article, Airline Data Versus Your Preference. More than 30 years on the road has convinced me of one thing. Business travel is a selfish pursuit. It's why some of us continue flying on an airline that other frequent flyers consider loathsome. We're completely obsessed with our own treatment, and we naturally rate airlines based on our personal experiences with it. What the experts say doesn't matter. What talking heads like me say is irrelevant. What our fellow road warriors say is meaningless. We know what we like and what we hate. We're loyal to what works for us and steer clear of the carriers that have done us wrong. Still, there are objective standards. The arbiter of accuracy when it comes to the basics, on-time operation, lost bags, and the like, is the monthly U.S. Department of Transportation Air Travel Consumer Report. The most recent edition, published just a few days ago and covering flights in 2015, offers a statistical stroll through the industry that is worth a few minutes of your time. What appears below is the combined wisdom of millions of flights and tens of millions of our fellow flyers. I understand your mileage may vary. Traveling through time. If on-time arrivals are what you seek, Delta Airlines would have you believe that it is the carrier of choice, but that's not exactly true. Delta's record of timely flights, 85.9% arriving within 15 minutes of their published schedule, is well above the 2015 industry average of 79.9%. Yet it's only good for third place among the 13 carriers tracked by the Transportation Department. Even if you discount the industry leader, Honolulu-based Hawaiian Airlines, 88.4% on time in 2015. For geographic reasons, Delta is still bested by Alaska Airlines. Seattle-based Alaska wrapped up an 86.4% rating. Delta does outperform its legacy carrier competitors, however. American Airlines finished fourth in 2015 at 80.3%, and United Airlines finished eighth with a 78.2% rating. Curse of the regionals. Be warned, those numbers exclude the generally poor on-time performance of the legacy airlines' commuter carriers. These so-called regional airlines handle about half of the industry's flying and are listed separately by the DOT. Envoy, the wholly owned commuter carrier of American Airlines, finished 11 out of 13 carriers with an awful 74.1% rating. ExpressJet, which operates flights for Delta, American, and United, finished in the ninth slot and managed an on-time rating of 77.9%. SkyWest, which flies for all three legacy lines and Alaska Air, too, managed a sixth-place finish, basis points below the industry average of 79.7%. If it was just poor on-time performance that plagued regionals, you could charitably suggest it was an anomaly. But it isn't. According to DOT figures for 2015, regional airlines also finished dead last in baggage handling efficiency, and they involuntarily bumped the most passengers holding valid tickets. For 2015, the industry as a whole mishandled the checked bags of 3.24 of every 1,000 flyers. But SkyWest, 4.05, ExpressJet, 5.06, and Envoy, 8.52, screwed up much more frequently. They were also more likely to deny you a seat. In 2015, that happened to fewer than one flyer in 10,000, 0.76. But SkyWest's bump rate was more than twice as high, 1.78 per 10,000 flyers, and ExpressJet, 1.86, and Envoy, 2.35, were worse. Executives at regional airlines claim that their numbers are skewed because their big carrier patrons slough off missed connections on them. That leads, they insist, to less timely operations and more baggage and ticketing snafus. The guys in the middle. The so-called alternate carriers run about the middle of the performance pack. Virgin America ranks fifth in on-time efficiency, literally at the industry average of 79.9% on time. It had the fewest mishandled bags in the industry, however, with only 0.84 reports per 1,000 flyers. It ranked third in denied boarding, bumping just 0.12 passengers per 10,000 flyers. For its part, JetBlue Airways ranked just behind Virgin America in baggage handling efficiency, with 1.81 reports per 1,000 passengers. And it can boast that you were least likely to be involuntarily bumped from your seat. JetBlue handled 31.9 million passengers in 2015, and only 73 were denied a seat, a minuscule ratio of 0.02 per 10,000 flyers. JetBlue's Achilles heel? On-time performance. It ranked 10th of 13 airlines, operating just 76% of its flights on schedule. It's true that JetBlue's busiest airports, Logan in Boston and JFK in New York, are plagued with snowy winters and stormy summers, But the carrier's woes are more internal than meteorological. JetBlue does a poor job boarding and disembarking passengers, and that drags down its timeliness. Southwest Airlines, which offers two free checked bags to all flyers and eschews change fees, is also a mid-level operator. It came in seventh in timeliness, 79.7%, eighth in baggage handling, 3.31 reports per 1,000 flyers, and 10th in denied boarding, bumping 1.08 passengers per 10,000 flyers. The high cost of low fares. Spirit Airlines and its clone, Frontier Airlines, contend their ultra-low fare carrier, ULCC model, allows customers to save money because flyers only purchase the products and services they want. I'd argue that the ULCC operators are bait-and-switch hucksters that invent all sorts of fees to offset low advertised prices. But what is not at issue is how awful they are as airlines. Spirit and Frontier have the least spacious standard coach seats in the United States, with as little as 28 inches of legroom compared to the 30 to 32 inches offered by competitors. Spirit is also the worst airline for on-time operations in the nation, finishing in 13th and last, at 69%, 9.9% lower than the industry average. Frontier is only a bit better in 12th place at 73.2%. Spirit and Frontier are also the most complained about airlines. The Transportation Department received 12,771 official passenger complaints in 2015 for an industry average of 1.9 gripes per 100,000 flyers. More than 24% of the total was directed at Spirit and Frontier. Spirit's complaint rate, 11.73, was more than six times the industry average. Frontier, at 7.86 gripes per 100,000 customers, was more than four times worse than the industry average. A note about airfares. DOT fare compilations lag behind the industry's operational statistics, so a separate report only covers the third quarter of 2015. The agency pegged the average domestic fare at $372 in 2015, down more than 6% from the third quarter of 2014. But the average fare, which no one actually pays, of course, is misleading. Why? The DOT says fares in 2015 represented only 75% of the revenue that airlines extracted from us for flights. The rest was fees for checked bags, ticket changes, and other items. As recently as 1995, however, fares represented 87.6% of the price we paid to fly. And with the minutes we have left with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read from the 9 to 5 column in the small business section, which starts off with Homes by Dickerson honored by Howe's for best customer service. Homes by Dickerson of Raleigh was recently awarded Best of Customer Service 2016 on digital home remodeling and design platform Houzz. The 40-year-old home builder was selected among more than 1 million active home building, remodeling, and design industry professionals. The Best of Houzz is awarded annually in three categories: design, customer service, and photography. Customer service honors are based on multiple factors, including positive client reviews received in 2015. We are so thrilled to receive the Best of Customer Service Award from Howe's, as it reinforces that our attention is on the most important aspect of the business, our clients, says Brant Chesson, president and CEO of Homes by Dickerson. With an industry as vast as home building, we feel so honored to have been recognized. Kim Lee Horn takes top honors for Fidelity Garage. Kim Lee Horn and Associates of Raleigh earned a national award for engineering achievement in the American Council of Engineering Companies' 49th Annual Engineering Excellence Awards for its design of a new 2030 space parking deck at the Fidelity Investments campus in Research Triangle Park. The facility features multiple vehicular access points, a structural connection to a new pedestrian bridge, and exterior-interior dedicated pedestrian walkways. Fitting the structure on a site constrained by both natural and built features required the use of multiple sloping parking bays, which minimized excavation. The council recognized 151 engineering achievements throughout the U.S. and the world. Award criteria included uniqueness and originality, technical innovation, social and economic value, complexity, and success in achieving goals. Zen Design Build, now under sole ownership. Chapel Hill designer-builder Carol Ann Zinn has become the sole owner of her company, Zinn Design Build, which she launched in 1978. Zinn designs and builds custom homes, additions, and remodels for the Chapel Hill and Durham markets from her office at 180 Providence Road in Chapel Hill. "The formula for a beautiful home is different for everyone," says Zinn. "I will continue to build on my strong reputation for integrating client aesthetic desires and budget with the latest trends and current building costs." Brooks Pierce named Firm of the Year. The Brooks Pierce Law Firm, with offices in Raleigh, Greensboro, and Wilmington, was named the 2016 Firm of the Year in North Carolina by independent research firm Benchmark Litigation. The award was presented in February at a reception in New York City. Other North Carolina law firms named as finalists for the 2016 Firm of the Year Award are Ellis & Winters, Parker Poe Adams & Bernstein, and Smith Anderson. Four Oaks Bank rebrands Wealth Management Group. Four Oaks Banks has changed the name of its financial services division from Four Oaks Financial Services to Four Oaks Wealth Management. Four Oaks Bank established its financial services division in 2002 to give customers and the people in the communities it serves convenient access to financial management and planning services. "We chose to update our name to reflect the evolution of our program and to better clarify the complete range of professional wealth management services we provide for our customers," says Chris Vasquez, Senior Vice President and Manager of Four Oaks Wealth Management. And we're going to stop right there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.